ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 28 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Morgan & English Law Firm. I'm Justin Darcy, and joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke, along with our special guest, Steve Davis. A voice and a face that is well-known and renowned in the industry, Steve is currently auctioneer for Magic Millions, New Zealand Bloodstock, and quite famously, which we'll touch on a little later, Bloodstock South Africa. From presenting on trackside in New Zealand to auctioneering some of the finest horse flesh from around the world, and even a background thought of a career in teaching, Steve now finds himself on today's podcast. Steve, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Yeah, nice to be joining you. Thank you.
Firstly, a proud Kiwi, tell us about your early years going racing with your old man at Hawke's Bay. Is this where you caught the racing bug and the passion for the sport?
Yeah, look, I think anybody involved in racing gets that interest either from a family member or a friend. You go there and if you have a good experience, which I did, my father was a little punter, and I have great memories of backing horses like Game and things like that. I'm really showing my age, but they were the days. I mean, just down in Hawke's Bay, I mean, we used to have sawdust on the floor of the pub, on the public bar at the back, and you used to put your money on the front, and you have to go round the back of the tote to collect. Those were the days. And, there was a floor, Taylor, you love this, there was a floor on the member stand for men only.
Wow, well, that's not something that I'd like to see, but we're glad to see that that's changed these days. But how, I guess, have you seen the industry change, I guess, from those days? Obviously, now women are allowed on all floors of the members' stand, but back in the day when you were going to the races, how has it changed?
Oh, it's changed enormously in terms of the number of people involved. I mean, there's so much alternative now. I remember growing up, the only soccer we used to get was the FA Cup final. That was the only, time we'd ever watched. Now you get it every day of the week if you want to watch international sport. And I think that's the change. And I think we were slow to adapt as an industry, the racing industry, that, we're part of the entertainment. As much as it's a business, we're part of the entertainment thing. And as a result of the exposure, you can sit and watch golf now from America. And that change has been enormous. And so what happens is, instead of people going to the races, we sit at home. We watch it on TV. And the better we get at doing it, presenting it on TV, less inclined people are to go to the races. And the worry I have with that is, while we create punters, we don't create owners. And without owners of the product, we don't have a product to which to bet on. So it's a catch-22 in some ways in terms of that. I love the fact of what we're doing about the big days, because you can't get people back the second time until they've been the first time. But, that to me has been the change. I mean, we used to go and park our car at Hawke's Bay in the morning, and I'd go off to play soccer, or else you'd be out on the road somewhere. Now you go after the second race and you're still only in the second line of cars, if Hawke's Bay were running, obviously.
We'll touch on now, you were originally looking at becoming a teacher, but obviously that hasn't panned out and you find yourself now as an auctioneer. Could you tell us a bit about how that sort of came about?
Well, I was doing the Sunday workouts at Alexandra Park, and a guy came up to me and said, have I ever done any auctioneering? King Kramer Roberts. And I said no, but I used to joke about having a job like the great Peter Kelly. And he said, why don't you get some experience? So I went along to Michael Floyd, as history knows, and then he sent me down to John Hudson, and then all of a sudden they turned around and offered me a job, and I thought, well, I'll take it for the Christmas holidays, my holiday period, because I really wanted to be a teacher. I was going to go and reapply. Well, I did. I reapplied to become a primary school teacher. I was doing be in that stage, which was university and teachers college, and I hated going to university, to be quite frank, and hence I failed my university. And also the board of directors suggested in December that I should pursue another line of employment rather than being accepted for primary school teaching. So as history will know, my holiday job became very much my full-time vocation, and I'm pleased to say it worked out pretty well. I don't know, I'd run a I love teaching. I love to see that spark, that twinkle in their eye when the kids get it, when you're out on section and they finally get it, or you get them to do things that perhaps, they were shy, you get them in front of the class, et cetera. So there's aspects of it I've enjoyed of teaching, but I must admit I've loved the auctioneering side of things.
You mentioned that you love the teaching side of things, but I still feel like that might be something that you do a little bit of in your current role. There's a lot of young guns aspiring to be like yourself in the auctioneering ranks. do you find yourself being a teacher to some of these young guns? And I guess what, along with that, there must be a bit of fulfillment with what could have been your career as well.
Yeah, look, and that's the one thing I've got to say about my early days. You know, I was very fortunate. I worked under Kevin O'Connor. He was outstanding. I learned from him. I stood next to him and learned from him. But there are a lot of auctioneers that probably didn't help me much going through for whatever reason. And I've always been open to saying, hey, look, you know, I'd love to, the greatest pleasure I would get is an auctioneer, once I've stepped down, and that may not be that far away, that these guys are going to turn around and say, look, Steve Davis, every time we asked him for information or help, he was there to give that. And that's what I love, you know, is that next generation coming through. We don't need 25 Steve Davises out there, and God knows we don't need them too quick coming through. You know, there are a few out there, they're looking good, but you know, at the end of the day, I'd take great pleasure in someone saying, look, I'd like to thank Steve Davis for all the help he's given me, and it gives me great pleasure to see people progressing and developing.
On your auctioneering career itself, you started off, well, I read that you started off in stock and stations, so selling livestock. What was the biggest learning curve that you personally took from that experience and you've been able to implement into your career auctioneering bloodstock?
I think it's the interaction, again, working under Kevin O'Connor. I think it's that interaction with the buyers, you know, form a relationship with them. You've obviously got to form a relationship with your vendor, and you've got to do your homework. I think the bottom line, that's, you know, whether you're selling sheep, whether you're selling real estate, whatever else, and obviously horses, you've got to do your homework. You've got to, you know, do that. And I've been very fortunate in some ways throughout my career to appreciate that. And that's the one thing I've focused on, is making sure you cross your T's, dot your I's, and, you know, things should happen.
We know you're ever so good at selling the thoroughbreds, and we know you know how to prepare for that well, but we've also been told you auctioneer for the New Zealand Fine Art Society. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I got asked to do the art auctions, and I thought, geez, I know nothing about art, quite frankly, you know. But my wife said, you know, why don't you do it just for a bit of a fun? And, of course, the beautiful thing is that most of the people at that stage, in fact, probably 99% of them hadn't heard my jokes. So it was quite good to go along and recite some of these obvious things. And at the end of the day, it's the same psyche, isn't it? At the end of the day, you know, what's the value of a horse? What's the value of a piece of art? It's what two people are prepared to pay. And so, you come out with some great quips. And, I made a couple of faux pas, very much so with my in my early days of art auctioneering. And I don't know whether you've got time. I mean, I was selling for Ida Carey, who was a local artist. And she actually set up the Waikato Art Society. I think she was part of it. And so half the people knew her. I didn't know her at all. The other half. Anyway, I was selling three or four paintings of hers, of which two were of the family, of her family, of which I couldn't sell. And one was of the living room, which made over the reserve. And I said, clearly she should have painted more of the house than the family. Well, half the audience laughed and the other half didn't weren't amused, I've got to say, yes.
You mentioned there about you having to do study and a bit of homework for anything that you are selling. What's the homework and study for art?
Oh, well, it's, you know, thankfully I had a man who was helping me in terms of the background, but you're selling 50, you know, a piece of art every 50 seconds, you know, or a minute, let's say. So you don't have to say it's, you know, it's oil on, you know, thing, or it's somebody who's got an art degree, you know, or somebody went through whatever else, you know, their art sold up to whatever else in terms of amounts and things. You know, you're trying to, I suppose, engender some interest. But a lot of the stuff that I did, I was only the bottom end stuff, to be fair. You know, it's something that I liked, and I'd say, gee, this is nice, isn't it? You know, whatever else, you know, but you've seen it and away you go. But I mean, the other line is, look, if you don't bid up and buy, you're going to have to go around, knock on the door and ask him to have a look at it on his place, you know, on his wall, you know. Whose wall do you want to see it on, that piece of art, you know?
Absolute classic. We'll just touch back on the horses and bloodstock for a minute here and a couple of particular horses that you've sold through the ring. Just in terms of, you know, being at the sales, a general person at the sales generally has an idea of what horses are going to make money. Everyone has their own idea of what horses will make. Generally, they're around the mark. I guess from a high-end point of view to a lower end, do you find that there's a big difference in your own preparation from selling a horse that's expected to make seven figures to that of a horse down the bottom end of that particular market?
No, I mean, obviously not. I mean, at the end of the day, you're trying for that vendor. That's the bottom line. And invariably, the better horses sell themselves. You know, they're actually in there. Ironically, you've got to work harder on the lesser ones. And I think that's the one thing I take a great deal of pride in is that you're working just as hard, and it gives me a great thrill. You know, if somebody says, look, you know, I'm hoping to get 10,000 for this horse, and you get them 50 or 60, you know, in effect, it's almost life-changing. And, you know, and I've sold horses for people that made $1 million. You turn around, they say, oh, yeah, I thought it would make that. You know, you think, oh, gee, you know, okay. It's a lot of money, you know. And at the end of the, you know, I think you do your best. You get up there and sell. You try and say something or try and encourage someone to have that other bit. But to be quite frank, we're prima donnas if we think I have too much, you know, involvement over the value of the horse. You know, you, as you've just said, buyers come there with a perception as to what they're prepared to pay. Very, you know, in all due respect, you know, we can do whatever we want. There are times when you think you have an influence and you'd like to think so. That's why I get paid. The exorbitant money I get paid, I wish, that you have an influence on the actual outcome, you know, the actual price, you know, if it's what people are prepared to pay, as I said to before, like art, you know, it's only what two people are prepared to pay. And that's the beautiful thing about horses. I love about horses is that a horse can come in and make 100,000 that people thought would make 10,000. You know, it's only what two people are prepared to pay.
You mentioned there about trying to, you know, incite people to spend a little bit more or have another bid, and you do create that sort of atmosphere. Nothing more exciting than when you're sitting in the ring and you hear Steve Davis tap the gavel and say, oh, here he is, or you have these certain catchphrases that I think excite the people at the auction. And you've got this one great catchphrase that you know him very well for, and it's always buy the one you want rather than the one that's left.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, I don't know. That one hasn't been plagiarised. That's actually probably mine. I can stand up and take that one. Yeah, and it does work. It works for the art as well. It works for everything. You know, always buy the one you want rather than the one that's left. And when you think about it, and it works just about every time, because at the end of the day, this is the one they want. This is the one they want. You know, why wait for the second one? This is the one. Buy this one. And, you know, I mean, I have plagiarized a few other lines, but that probably is the one thing that I've used myself, and I use it quite often, you know.
This episode is brought to you by Morgan & English Commercial Lawyers, more than just a law firm. They work like external in-house counsel, getting to know you and your business. With offices in Sydney, Scone and Tamworth, and years of experience in the agriculture and thoroughbred industries, Morgan & English deliver practical solutions that work in the real world. Whether it's contracts, disputes, or big picture advice, they're the kind of firm you want in your corner. One thing that I've read is that you attended auctioneering school. For those that don't know anything about it, myself included, what actually is auctioneering school? What do you learn, and how long does it go for?
Well, I went to some of those early ones. What do you learn? Not a lot in some regards, because it's unnatural. It's not a real auction system, you know, it's a situation. You're listening to people. I mean, I've taken them too for different livestock companies have asked me to go along. And you're really looking for technical things in terms of patter and et cetera, because you can't recreate the urgency or the stress or the nervousness that are involved in an auction, you know, in terms of selling for a vendor or selling to people buying. But you're just listening to the technical things. It might be just the posture. It might, as I say, it might be just the patter, little things that they can do if they drop off towards the end of, instead of lifting up and knocking it down and things like that. They can go for an hour, a couple of hours, I suppose. You know, you listen to them and you critique them in the hopes that after doing that, they're going to take on board what you've said.
Have you seen changes in how you need to use your voice and what you need to talk about and how you can best sell a horse in today's ring compared to, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
I think there's certainly has changed. You know, we're on speed. You know, we're on speed dial. I mean, we used to 30 lots an hour. Now they're wanting to go a little bit quicker. And I think there's got to be a balance. There's got to be a balance to that. You know, if you do the sums, it takes a person 1 million minutes to get that horse to the ring. 1 million minutes. And I don't think 2 minutes is out of the way in which to sell that horse. And I think, you know, and I've always said this too, you know, introductions, you're really just stroking the ego of the vendor, because the bottom line is the buyer in front knows about it. He knows anyway. He's done his homework on the horse in terms of the pedigree updates per se. But in saying that, the vendor has a right to have you say that the half-brother won the Derby 2 weeks ago, you know? So there's a little thing. It's just getting the balance right. I look at every horse I sell. So you're looking for physical. I think from my perspective, it's more important to say something that physically may be appealing, that may reinforce in the mind of the buyer what I'm thinking. You know, gee, have a look at the hind quarter on this. Look at the way it walks. you know, and the guy sitting back or the lady sitting back saying, do you know, I thought the same thing. I thought he walked really well too. And so you're reinforcing them, giving them confidence to buy what they really want. And that's all you want. Always buy the one you want.
We also see you loving to have a chat with bidders. And when I say chat, I mean you ask them questions and tell them they don't have the bid and tell them they're missing out on the next champion. But also, how do you use that sort of silence and that slower pace to your advantage as well and create that bit of anticipation? And how do you think that sort of affects the bidding?
Well, I think you become like white noise if you keep doing it at the same level and pace and speed and noise. You know, if you drop it down, all of a sudden say, geez, what's happened? You know, the sound's gone, you know. And quite often I chat away just to delay, to give you a bit of space, you know, instead of going $50,000 an hour to $50,000 an hour. If you say, you know, you start talking to them, all of a sudden not saying, for God's sake, knock it down. Would you knock it down? All of a sudden you're interacting. And often if they start doing the old, you know, signals to knock it down, you say, hang on, what are you're talking to me. Why are you telling me to do this? You're just slowing me down. So you interact with the people. And all I'm doing is stalling to give the other bloke a chance or person to bid again.
It's a clever tactic.
Don't tell anyone.
We'll keep it quiet on this public podcast. Obviously, you've had a lot of fond memories in the ring. What's been your fondest so far? And I guess, is there a particular day or a moment that you'd love to go back and relive again?
Look, you know, I go back to selling Octagonal, which I always thought was too cheap. And I can still remember looking across at Jack Eastgate, who was the Bozan man, who was underbidder. And he looked across at the Inghams and saw he was bidding against and shook his head and said no. But I always thought Octagonal was one of the cheapest horses I've sold. You know, I enjoy selling Imperatrice, you know, to get to that sort of level, 6.6 million is, you know, so rare. It's rarefied air. You're going to get a horse that makes that sort of money. And from a humour type thing, obviously, is, you know, the one in South Africa with the, you know, the vet report. The horse with the small penis, you know, that was memorable, you know, for different reasons. And it's ironically, you know, you sell Imperatrice for 6.6 million, sell a horse with a small penis, read a vet report, and it goes viral. You know, that's the industry of the world we're in. That's the world we're in now.
We'll go through some of those horses that you've seen go through the ring. And as you said there, Octagonal, 1994, Taylor and myself weren't around to see him.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Just rubbing it in. But we've certainly seen the legacy that this horse has left on the track, in the ring and in the barn. He was lot 121, $210,000 son of Zabil. The subsequent years of auctioneering, you've seen his sons and daughters and subsequent bloodlines walk through the ring. And how's it feel knowing you've been part of that history as well?
Well, I keep coming back to it, you know, and it's like we keep bringing it up when I'm selling. You talk about lines, you know, you get to 210, that's the Octagonal number. Obviously, 230 is Winks, you know, with Grant Burns. And I was only one lot away from selling Winks, I got to say. Can I just say, I'm one lot away from, you know, having Grant Burns having nothing to say, you know. look, it's great, but I'm a very small part of it, you know, with all due respect. You know, you get up and it's as I say. I mean, I was one lot away from selling Winks. Maybe I wouldn't have made it 230. You know, she might have made 150. I go back to Don Eduardo, who made 3.6 million. Simon Vivian sold it. I wouldn't have sold it for 3.6 now. I wouldn't have hung on like he did, waiting for Kawanga to get his phone back and everything else, his phone line. Or maybe I did. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, those are the things. You're a part of it. They're a very small part.
The Imperatrice one would have been an interesting example because she wasn't actually there in the ring. It's all virtual. How does that experience differ from those horses that you've had in the ring?
I think it's the way forward, quite frankly. I honestly think the virtual sale and the way Magic Millions do it, I think that is the future, those, especially those big mares. Because at the end of the day, it's like an iceberg when you get to that stage as to who's going to be bidding on it. You know, you really are talking three or four people. Five people, maybe, if you look overseas, it might, you know, half a dozen perhaps, people that would be interested. And so why bring her to the sale ring? Why put her through the stress and everything else, putting her through a ring or putting any horse through that's at that sort of value? And I think going forward, we will see more of it where the actual physical thing of the horse isn't going to make that much difference. People will go and look her on the farm, look her on the property, wherever she may be, in the stable, whatever else. And I think that is the future for those bigger mares. It's the way to go. Having her standing there in front of Coolmore or Yulong or whoever it may be, John Stewart or whoever, is not going to influence the bid. They'll have done their homework, and it's a case of then competing one against another. And with the urgency of the auctioneer, I don't like online sales, I've got to say, because they are career limiting for auctioneers, online sales. Virtual sales are good.
As you said earlier, I guess a horse like Imperatrice sells herself. She's a 10-time Group 1 winner. She doesn't need to be in the ring for someone to want to buy her. But we'll touch on now Bloodstock South Africa. You mentioned earlier that famous moment from 2023 with the horse with the underdeveloped penis. We'll play some audio now for our listeners.
Ladies and gentlemen, with respect to 164, this colt was born with a developmental abnormality of the penile sheath and an undeveloped penis. The testes and scrotum are normal. Just checking this not from my mother. Okay. This condition should not have any influence on his athletic ability or his ability to be an auctioneer.
She presents as a filly.
Yeah. Righto. That is the situation. I've read a few vet reports in my life, but that's one of the better ones. I might keep it and frame it. Anyway, his nickname's Steve.
But could you tell us your thoughts when you first saw this vet report come across your desk?
Well, it didn't come across my desk, Taylor. You know, I went and looked at the horses, I do with all the horses, and they said, hey, Steve, excuse my South African accent, hey, Steve, this horse has got a small dick. And I said, yeah, so well, why didn't you geld it? And they said, oh, I haven't, we've got a vet report. And I said, well, I'm coming back to get the vet report because I know these bloody vets, they use big, you know, big words and things. So I got the vet report in the morning of the sale. This was about 3 or 4 days before the sale. And so I picked up the vet report on the morning of the sale, and I read the first line, which was undevelopmental, and I kept on saying that, and I thought, geez, you know, look through, and there was no other big words. Yeah, I saw the occasional pen, no known big words, literally wrote 164 on the bit of paper and shoved it in my catalogue, and that was it. And then when I read it, I realised, and I thought it was the young guy, a younger vet whom I knew. I thought he was having me on. He stitched me up, but it was some vet. It was a vet outfit I'd never heard of. When I finally looked at the top of the page at the end, it wasn't the vets that I thought had written it. It was someone that I'd never heard of, and they used penis and penile about every other sentence. And of course, you've got 200 people in an auditorium, and you mentioned this is the other thing. If you've got 200 people in an auditorium or a hall or wherever you may be, if you say the word penis, 90% of the people start laughing. And that was the problem. I was sort of halfway through and people were laughing, and I could see a trainer I know, and Paul Lafferty, and the owner I know with him, and they're guffawing, and they're rolling backwards and forwards in their chair. I was reading this and it set me off. And the whole place was just erupting. You can't quite get it in the audio how loud the noise, the laughter was. And I said to Michael Holmes at the end, I said, I've got to get a copy of this report just for my keeping. And next minute it just exploded, went viral. Somebody who posted it, I never posted it per se, somebody didn't, it just went viral. I mean, yeah.
It's one of the best 2 minutes in the ring I think I've ever seen. And this is before the bidding even started. Do we know anything about this horse and what it's actually going on to do?
Yes. The irony is, and this is the irony, on debut, and I rang the people in Australia, South Africa, there was this War of Kingdoms, his name. All right, War of King. He got beaten ahead at his first start. There was a story to be written there. He's next two. He came out just last night, or not last night, a couple of nights ago, and got beat, ran second. But he has got ability. He's changed trainer. He's no longer with the trainer he had, but he looks very promising. War of Kingdoms. Write it down. He's a smart horse. And he's been gelded.
We'll definitely have to add him to the black book. We know you have a big interest in South African racing, obviously in the ring selling them, but I've heard you own a couple over there too. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your passion for racing over there?
Well, it's cheap, isn't it? That's the beautiful thing. You're dealing, there's not a lot of outlay, and it's a little bit of fun. And you know, I've had little shares and horses, and then the trainer that I'm know and get on very well with, my neighbor said to me, I wouldn't mind racing a horse in South Africa with you. And I came back and I said, I bought a little couple anyway. Then the trainer said, look, I'm going to do a syndicate of 100 for 100 horse shares, and you pay one figure and no more to pay. And it was 3,500 rand. for 1% share in the horse. So that's $350 Kiwi, probably $300 Australia, as it is now. Anyway, $350. My neighbour said, geez, that sounds good. I'll be a part of that. And another neighbour said, geez, I'm into that. So I put my son in and my father-in-law in. We kept the shares. We took 5% of the first one. And then they did it again with a filly. About 2 weeks later, they did another one. And I thought, oh, I said to the guy, I said, yeah, no, we're into that. Well, those two horses, one is called Fairy Knight, who is still racing. He's won 10 races, a black type horse, nearly won the Triple Crown over there at Fairview. And the other was Joy and Peace, who won 8 races, listed winner. And then she just sold recently for 665,000 Rand. And so everybody got their money back and more. And the beautiful thing is my neighbours never reinvested. I mean, we bought into another one who's gone okay. There was one that was no good. And we got another one as well. So, and they've got more money back than what they put in. I paid them out the other day from the funds from the sale of Joy and Peace. And they've still got 3 horses racing over there. Well, shares in 3 horses, 1%. Hey, but as we know with syndicates, 1%, you get 100% of the fun. You know, it doesn't matter. 100% of the enjoyment is beautiful.
Absolutely. It's funny, just before this podcast, Taylor and I were chatting about syndication and how important that actually is for the industry. And yeah, no doubt you've seen a big impact, obviously both being involved with syndication and from syndications, buying horses, and I guess more and more being involved in the sport. They're a great thing for the sport, in our opinion anyway.
Yeah, no question. And that's the one thing South Africa is slowly turning in. These were sort of new things. Syndication is not big in South Africa. It's starting to grow. It's starting to develop. But that's the one bonus that Australia has. It's opened up the world of racing to everybody, you know, as we've seen with people owning shares and horses that come out, won the Golden Slipper, etc. They could be the candlestick maker, the baker, you know, whoever. They've got a share, whether it's 2.5%, 5% or whatever. They have a share in something and you get 100% of the fun. And quite often, being a part of the syndicate, you actually enjoy it more because you've got someone to share it with. You know, you're sitting there, you win a race, you're sitting on your own like Billy No Mates. Who are you going to tell, you know? So it's great to just share the fun.
We want to strip it back now. So we know Steve Davis, the auctioneer. We see him on the broadcast and we hear your voice. But on the days where we don't see that, what is your role as being an auctioneer and being part of these auction houses?
Well, obviously Magic Millions retained me through the year. So we've just completed trying to attract the right sort of horses to come over from New Zealand to sell at the Magic Millions in January. We'll then work on buyers throughout the different times of the year to come over and support the sales in terms of purchases, whether it be weanlings to come back, etc. And then obviously, as you say, I the first 6 months of the year I'm hardly home with the sales that are on. Obviously with Magic Millions themselves interwoven into that, it's the sales in South Africa and the sale here in New Zealand. It's the back end of the year where it slows down a little bit. I do a bit of MC work. I do one conference every year. And one conference in Australia. It's the aggregates and quarrying industry. Yeah. Aggregates and quarrying industry, turning big rock into small rock. I've done that for 25 years. And I suppose that's the one thing, you know, if I look back on my career of everything is that, and I've, you know, obviously trackside's no longer, but COVID's brought an end to that. But is the longevity is that, you know, I've kept doing the same things for a long time. And, you know, I must be doing something right, I suppose.
The Brisbane Racing Club, Queensland's premier destination for horse racing, events and world-class hospitality. As a Brisbane Racing Club member, you'll enjoy exclusive perks and unforgettable experiences at one of Australia's leading racing clubs. Unlock unlimited members reserve access across Eagle Farm and Doomben, including the thrilling 2026 Stradbroke season. Join today at brc.com.au and feel closer to the thrill, prestige and excitement of Brisbane's thoroughbred racing scene.
Pedigrees are so important when you're auctioneering and keeping up with the current trends and what's actually happening on the track. How are you able to retain that information? Is it just off the top of your head? Do you have to really study it? How do you
able to
pull up all these facts?
No, I'll tell you, you do study it and you do a lot of research. And that's what I come back to at the beginning. You don't step up there, you know, blindly having just arrived. So, you know, I'll look at every horse I sell. I look at the pedigree when I'm selling it. You're looking down the page to see if there are any close relations, three-quarter relations, or whatever. You can determine from that as to why the the vendor or the breeder, should I say, bred that horse, that mare to that stallion, whether it be, you know, there's a close relation to a Tavistock horse and they bred it to Tarzino. I can see now why they bred this to that. And then I'll do a lot of work with Arian in terms of size and look for nicks and crosses and everything else as to what works, you know, like Tavachi. So you say, Tavachi, geez, been disappointed. I tell you what, out of Zababeel mares, his strike rate with Zababeel is outstanding. And so you winterwove all that sort of stuff in to what you're doing, what you're selling.
We've got a lot of different people buying different horses for different prices, and you don't have to name anyone in particular, but do you have a particular style that you use to auction for certain individuals in a bidding war? We know Mr. Ellis likes to wink, but are there any other sort of niche little things that you see?
Well, you know, as I say, obviously, you know, with David Ellis and things like that, you're looking for those certain winks, etc. But the one that I always love, and it happened beautiful, it was actually not my doing, it was Kieran Moore came to me and he said, Steve, he said, I'm going to have my book, my pen and my book. He said, well, I've got my pen and my book, my catalogue, just keep taking my bids. And it happened both at the Gold Coast and at Karaka, where he had his book and his pen and his catalogue, and I turned to him, just turned back without the bid spotter or anybody making a noise. And it was so effective because the underbidder, who turned out to be the under, was thinking I was either A, running them up, or wondered where I was getting the bids from, couldn't work out who it was, etc. And at the Gold Coast, where it happened at the Gold Coast, I knocked it down to Kerrimore, and the guy was actually talking to somebody. And they couldn't believe it either that I'd knocked this horse down to Kerrimore without him moving anything. He simply had the pen and the book. It doesn't happen often. Now, obviously, you've got to have the confidence. He's got to have the confidence in me that I'm not going to take him up and above anything else that he's prepared to pay.
Yeah, it's a tricky balancing act, those ones. It's it's almost an art watching this happen. Sometimes you see a bit of rapport between the bidder and potentially a bid spotter, or a bidder and yourself and as an auctioneer. Are these just... I guess, how do those things actually get organized? Is it just the bidder comes up to you and goes, okay, you know, let's, you know, I'm going to put the pen in the book and we'll go from there?
Yeah, well, that happened in that particular game, you know, and I'm sure it happens with the bid spotters. And that's where, you know, in an environment like Magic Millions, where you got such a big area to cover that, you know, I've always said to the bid spotters, you're an extension of me. You've got to interact with the buyer because I can't see who they are. And the older I get, the further out I can't see. And the bottom line, it's just a big moving, you know, it's such a big audience. And so you're reliant on the bid spotters to form that relationship with them. And the interesting thing, you know, as auctioneers and as bid spotters will tell you, is you know when somebody's going to bid because they change. Their demeanor changes. They've sat there for an hour, haven't moved. All of a sudden, they stiffen. They're looking at you. They're looking at the horse. They're looking around, looking at the tote, you know, looking at the bid board. Everything changes. Their demeanor changes. And they wonder sometimes as to how we know they're going to bid because they change. They physically change without even realizing it that they were going to bid on the horse, and you pick them up straight away. If you're good as a bid spotter, you'll notice these things, you know.
You mentioned there that obviously Magic Millions, it's so big, it's so open, there's so many people there and the theatre is incredible. But you do auction across, you know, the three different auction houses. What's the difference between the three in your eyes and how you bid and how you auction?
Yeah, good question. And I've got to say, I sell differently, subtly different at every place. Certainly at Karaka, it's more one-on-one. I can see who's bidding and I can work directly to the buyer themselves. Whereas Magic Millions, you know, I work the crowd. When I say work the crowd, work my bid spotters. You know, I'll interact with them more because I'm talking to them, not knowing who they're taking the bids off. So I'm asking them to ask the question. There is a subtle difference in how you approach that sale, because at Magic Millions, I'm really reliant on my boys to do the work, girls, you know, out there doing the business, bid spotting, to interact, to get that one bid out of that person. And I've said to them, you know, you get one more bid out of somebody, you've paid for yourself for the day. And, you know, Magic Millions, I mean, Bloodstock South Africa is a little bit, because they've got an outside ring, which we can't see. We've got a person next to us who's mic'd up with an outside ring as well. One thing also that, you know, Magic Millions and Bloodstock South Africa do now is they feed and water people in the auditorium. So they're very fortunate they can retain a lot of people in the auditorium throughout the whole day. The downside to Karaka, as much as I love selling at Karaka because it's there, it empties out. I call it ebbs and flows, like high tide, low tide. You know, you'll be standing up there as an auctioneer at Karaka, next minute the pit fills up. And you think, oh, there's something coming in. There's something, you look ahead as you sell it away, $50,000 down to 50 years, you get, here it is. Yeah. You know which one they're all coming in for. You know, it's coming up. It's great, yeah.
We know you enjoy the show of the Magic Millions and it's the theatre of it, as Justin said before. It's all so exciting. We know you're a showman and you used to be a trackside presenter, including on a Monday night with Brian Martin presenting the Greyhounds. How long did you do that for?
A number of years. I actually off the track started from doing the Mondays. They cut out us going on track for a while there, and I said, well, let's just give me a quiet studio shift and I'll do something with it and I'll get a guest in. And so we started bringing guests in between the races at the, you know, Greyhounds. I'd have a guest and we'd interact with them. But I mean, I've always been attracted to people with passion, and Brian Martin had passion for greyhound racing, and you wonder what makes him so passionate about this, you know. And so you get drawn in, and I'm a super lover of greyhound race, but I mean, at the end of the day, one, it was part of the job on the Monday, so I had to learn. But also, you get caught up in it because his enthusiasm for it, you get dragged along and you start to understand about the downgraders and everything else that happens with greyhound racing. Yeah.
Now, you were recently awarded the NZTBA Media Personality of the Year. Congratulations, first and foremost. Obviously, an incredible award to win. For those that don't know about the award or any history behind it, would you be able to tell us what it is and, I guess, what it means to yourself to actually win it?
It initially was set up. It was the Waikato Breeders Personality of the Year. Then, obviously, NZ, the breeders have now taken over the whole thing. So, you know, I suppose it's broadened its scope, so to speak. I suppose, a recognition for what, you know, the work people have done in the industry. And I suppose from my point of view, it's been, you know, 1984 was my first ever year. 1984, selling people. Your parents, were they alive then? Yeah, stop shaking your head, Taylor. Thinking that. Yeah, no, look, it's been a long time. And I was a surprised as hell that it happened. But it was just nice to be recognised for the work you do. You know, you get up, whether you're being paid as the MC or not, you're getting up and getting paid as an auctioneer, but you are working for the industry. And it was just nice. You know, you like to think, you know, when I used to do tracks, I always used to say, you know, how much information do we need and how much entertainment do you need? Because at the end of the day, you want people to stay and watch the TV for the whole day. If you try and tell them what's going to win in each race and you miss them a couple of races, they're going to turn off and think, geez, you know, have them back to winner. But if you keep them entertained, keep them, you know, in some ways turning the page when they have a loss, that's a positive, you know. They go again. Go again, people, you know. So, yeah, to get the personality was great. They gave me a jacket, which unfortunately I don't know whether I'll be able to wear. It's got New Zealand Personality of the Year written on it. I said to Nick Johnson, who puts New Zealand Personality of the Year on it? You know, I'm going to have to take that off. I don't know. No one's going to wear that. So anyway, but look, I'll it's a nice jacket, I've got to say. Stony Creek, very good people, very good.
That is unreal. Yeah, you mentioned there about your trackside days as well with, you know, potentially giving out some tips. We've been informed you're a bit of a quaddy king. Is there a little story behind this?
Not really, no. I do like my quaddies, though. I like taking the field in the first leg usually, because then if you get a blowout, then you're really up for something good. But no, I like the quaddies. You know, it's a small outlay for a big return. The other bit I like is in Australia, is in South Africa, the PA, where you've got to pick a horse that places in seven races. That's a nice one. As well. So I like those little multiple bets where you can have a little outlay and get a nice return. You know, $1.50 favourites, no good to me, to be quite frank, you know, because my $5, I've never been a big punter. You know, I started out mowing lawns as a kid getting $3. Yes, $3 for doing the lawns and take 6 50-cent doubles, or take, you know, half double that with a take and go and house with my late father. And that was everything. I used to spend everything I earned. You know, I'd earn $3 and spend a lot. I don't do that. I've always been a little punter, you know, $5, $10, maybe $20 to win. That would be a big bet for me.
I was told that you did take the coins out of the Christmas pudding to have a bet, so it must have started early in life.
Yeah, it did. Keith Satter, my cousin, Keith and I, we used to get coins in the old days in the steam pudding, and I think it was 70 cents we got, and yeah, we added to got a we took 250 cent doubles and had a collect. Yeah, so those were the days. Yeah, used to go down. Used to write the tickets out in my days, in the early days. Anzac Day, the TAB didn't open till 1 o'clock. If you hadn't bet a bet in the first race, you too late to get on. 50 used to close 50 minutes before the race had started. Yeah, those were the days. God, people, how you've changed. You wouldn't know, people.
These days, it's as simple as pulling out the iPhone and opening up
one of the apps. Yeah. Again, I've got to say, can I just say about the changes in New Zealand is that's the one thing that Entain have done, and it excites me to see racing being advertised on mainstream TV. You know, for too long, we've been stuck away preaching to the converted, you know, preaching to those actually involved. And it's just nice to see Betcher and everything else and people coming on. And at the end of the day, realistically, we've got to realize that people are betting. You know, my sons are the same. They bet on horses, but they'll bet more on, you know, on the old days, betting on basketball and everything else. It's the changing world we're in.
Absolutely. You mentioned there about Entain and the influence that they've had, especially in New Zealand across the last couple of years. New Zealand racing was looking a little bit grim there probably 3 or 4 years ago, and now having the support of Entain for the New Zealand racing community and I guess all three codes, just how important is that for the future of racing of all three codes in New Zealand?
Yeah, no question. Obviously, greyhound racing's not going to be with us much longer. So, yeah, look, I think it is so important that we've had a change in direction and encouragement, an investment in trying to broaden the base of people. And the only problem I have, as I mentioned right at the beginning, is the better that we get at showing TV, or showing racing on TV, less inclined people are to go to the races, and the less inclined people are possibly to race the product. You know, I think one of the sad things about Ellerslie is they used to have the people, I know, health and safety and everything else. They used to have people in the middle of with the horses going around, and the owners used to stand in the middle there of the parade ring. And I used to stand on the outside, gee, one day I'd like to be standing there. Now, unfortunately, they're stuck away in the corner behind a rail so to keep them safe from the horses. So it has I suppose you protect them in one way, but unfortunately you're not exposing the real opportunity for people to want to be a part of it. And that's the only fear I have, is the better we get at broadcasting racing, the less inclined people may be to go to the races. That's not the case in Australia. I appreciate that. Although they too, I mean, I went midweek meeting in Brisbane, and it was sort of like, you know, hang on, you just stand up and introduce yourself, people. There was that few people there, and it happens. I know we have industry days, but your big days, your Saturdays, and obviously the Everest and things coming up, super, you know, for getting people along. And as I've always said, you can't get them back the second time until they've been the first time.
And it's funny you mentioned there about Ellerslie, how you used to be able to have people standing in the middle of the parade ring, and you look in and you go, oh, you know, geez, I'd love to be involved in that one day. It's something I find, I look at Randwick, the way that that's set up, it's done very well because, you know, as you're looking in, the crowd's looking in at the owners in the middle of the parade ring. You look overseas and go to Ascot. Again, same thing. You've got everyone in the middle there. You've got a king standing there as well. It's just, it really does create, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's this feeling to just want to be involved, and a feeling of involvement and just wanting to be there.
You can't see it. I want to touch it. I want to be there. I want to get in there. I want to experience what that feeling is. And I suppose that's where syndication has helped people, that they've learned that joy, that 1% giving the 100% excitement that gives you that opportunity of standing in the middle of the parade ring there and having people look at you, you know. And it's not that Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame, but it's a real appreciation of that excitement that you only get from being a racehorse owner.
We'll finish off now. We've just got our fast five segment. It's just five quick fire questions for you to answer off the top of your head. And, yeah, just whatever comes to mind is your answer. So, Justin, if you want to kick us off with our first question.
Steve, your favourite restaurant to attend post the Magic Million sale?
Jamelli's.
Beautiful. Well, win or each way punter?
Each way, normally. Each way.
The favourite racetrack you've attended?
Flemington.
Now, this one, I might get in trouble for asking this one, but who's your favourite bid spotter at Magic Millions?
Matt Davis.
No bias at all. And, and just lastly, Steve, what's we often finish with this question. It is obviously an important question for anyone listening to this podcast, looking to come into the industry. What's one piece of advice you'd look to give someone trying to find their spot or their space?
Ask for advice. Go to somebody, and if you're not happy with the, you know, that they don't give you any help, go and ask somebody else. But ask as many questions as you can, and make sure you're doing something you love. You know, I'm blessed. I got to be saying, I am blessed. You work a job you love, you never work a day in your life, as they say, and that is very much the case. You know, I pinch myself. I get frustrated at times, and I got to look in the mirror and say to myself, hang on, you know, what are you actually doing, Stephen, here? You know, at the end of the day, you've got a job you enjoy, you love, people appreciate what you do, and you get paid for it. So, you know, do a job you love. Always do something you want to do.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today on the Business of Bloodstock podcast. It's been a thoroughly enjoyable sit down with you, and we are really grateful for your time today.
No, I appreciate it, and well done to you, team, for doing this. This is what racing in the industry needs, is these sort of things going forward.